pleasure of handing things over to Ashley Collins this morning. Many of you know Ashley. For those of you who don't, she's a graduate of NC State University with ag education undergrad, and then she got her master's in ag education from North Carolina A&T. Ashley has done a superb job of managing several projects within AgCareer.com, but one that gets underrated is our ambassadors, our student ambassadors. Ashley, how many have we had? Where are you?
We've had 54 different students from nearly 60 different universities.
So she does a good job, too, of helping recruit our interns and all of our college initiatives. She's also been very instrumental, along with Catherine Stone, in establishing our relationship with FFA. By the way, Clay Worley's over here, and Lori, where are you? She's here as well. If you have any questions on the items that Beth mentioned earlier, if you can see one of them, or even Catherine, she's in the back, so we'd be glad to talk to you. Oh, sorry. Dan is here as well. Sorry, Dan. He and I were traveling to, the other week together here in the Midwest, so Dan Rose can be available as well. Ashley, is it in your hands?
Well, I'm glad you all showed up this morning for the battle of wits between Rod and I. A little nervous about calling him up here to sit on this panel, and he has threatened me thoroughly, given yesterday's remarks. So we'll see how this turns out. Hopefully he won't beat me up too bad. So I'm going to have my panelists come forward. We're starting off this morning with a panel, which I think is great because it's we're going to open up conversation with the audience. We know from our evaluations that we do each year that this is one of the components of the roundtable that you all enjoy the most because you're getting to ask your questions. Don't be shy. Hopefully you won't be. I'm going to start off our panel this morning and ask some targeted questions to each of our panelists, and then we'll turn it over to the audience. I'll try to say this again, but you can't say it enough. We do have microphones that are available, and we'll kind of run those to you, or you can come to those microphones. It'll just help to make sure our speakers hear your question and are able to answer and cover everything that you're looking for. So this morning's panel is titled, and I have a big cord here I'm trying to avoid, Finding Tomorrow's Leaders. We spent yesterday kind of setting the stage for this noble profession that we work in, and then talking about the need for youth to come into our industry, to be excited about careers within our industry. So I am the meat of this is for you guys to ask questions, so I'm not going to go into great detail on the bios of each of our panelists. Obviously, you all met Rod yesterday when he spoke to us, but the bios are provided in our programs, and so you guys can all read that, I'm sure. But I will have them just kind of wave their hand. Sitting here closest to me, this is Connie Hargrave. She is from Iowa State University, and she runs the Science Bound program there. She's going to tell us a little bit more about that through our questions this morning. Sitting next to her is Pamela Morris, and she is from Purdue University. A large crowd from Purdue here this year, so she's another one of those. And then Rod Hamilton with Christensen Barnes sitting down there at the end. So, Connie, I'm actually going to start with you this morning and ask you if you could briefly explain the main focus of the Science Bound program there at Iowa State and what successes you've seen in that program to get more of a diverse group of young people encouraged about studying agriculture and careers in the ag industry.
All right, well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'll start by talking a little bit about Science Bound. Science Bound is Iowa State University's premier program to prepare students from ethnic groups that are underrepresented in technical fields for those technical fields to pursue those degrees in college and then also those careers. So the Science Bound program asks students and families of the age of 12 and 13 to make a five-year commitment to the program. A five-year commitment is about them taking the appropriate high school level courses, earning a minimum grade point average in those courses, participating in our STEM exposure, STEM experience activities, and then also getting them ready to go on to college. So it's a five-year commitment we ask them to make. In return, the university makes a nine-year commitment to each student. Students who complete our five-year program earn a four-year tuition scholarship to study in a STEM discipline. So the Science Bound program has been around for 23 years now. It's been replicated at Purdue University, as well. well. So when we talk about some of the successes in terms of growing students for ag-related careers, I think one of our biggest successes is using the term, we don't say STEM in science bound, we say A-STEM. We say A-STEM specifically because our students don't necessarily affiliate agriculture with the sciences. And so you'll hear a science bound student talk about pursuing A-STEM when you're thinking about agriculture, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I think also one of our biggest successes is a program that we've run with Pioneer, and that has been mentoring circles. What a mentoring circle is 4 to 5 high school students and a professional, an ag professional, happens to be from Pioneer. I'm doing some interactions in the after school phase. So they do it for 4 to 6 weeks. Gives the students the opportunities to interact with a professional in the school environment. The professional takes about 2 hours of their day when they participate, interact with the students. But that allows the students to do is make a personal connection with a STEM professional, in this case, an agriculturalist, so that they get exposure at a different level. It's not their teachers talking about ag. It's having that interaction. So on the first level, they get the experience with talking with a professional, a little bit more one-on-one. As a result of that, that professional gets a sense of today's youth. And usually what happens as a result of that is a little deeper connection, which piques students' interest to go into and explore ag. I think one of the other big benefits of that has been helping the students see a personal connection to agriculture, a personal relevance to it that maybe they had overlooked before. Certainly things that I know that all of you are familiar with, helping them to make that personal connection by having that interaction with a professional, not a teacher, not somebody who does the job day in and day out. That's been one of our biggest successes of piquing their interest and getting them to move on exploring agricultural sciences as a career possibility.
And Connie, you mentioned that the program also exists in Indiana at Purdue University, and Pamela may have a few comments about that as well. But before I jump to her with any comments, we do have a lot of Iowa and Indiana employers here. You mentioned this mentoring program and the program that you do with Pioneer. Are there any other states that you're aware of that have the Science Bound program? If we have members in here who would like for their company to get involved and they don't have locations in these states?
No, Science Bound is just at Purdue and at Iowa State University. There are other programs that are somewhat similar, some of the TRIO programs, maybe some of the Science Bound are Upward Bound Math and Science, have a similar opportunity, but not as tailored, not as focused as the Science Bound program.
And I love that she mentioned, I've not heard A-STEM, I have heard STEAM, to include agriculture in that terminology, so that's certainly a difference in calling it A-STEM. Pamela, do you have any comments regarding the Science Bound program there at Purdue?
Yes, I certainly do. As Connie has already stated, it is at Purdue only because President Martin Jiske, well, former President Martin Jiske, was at Iowa State. When he left Iowa State, he came to Purdue University. As soon as he arrived at Purdue, he established the Science Bound program at Purdue. And at Purdue, it is a collaboration between the Indianapolis Public School System and Purdue University. And so we currently have about 250 students in that program. We've got 84 students currently on campus, and we have I believe about 32 graduates from that program. So it has been a very successful program. We do have a parent component to the program, and I don't know how similar our programs are, because I know that Connie has adapted some new, ideas and initiatives into your current Science Bound program, but we do, I think, collaborate and talk quite frequently between the two universities regarding the Science Bound program, but it has been very successful at Purdue.
And Pamela, you have a very strong background in elementary education, working with younger students, and I think we all know the importance of talking to students at a young, young age to start this dialogue about the importance of agriculture. I have a big soapbox that I like to get on. I don't have children, but I like to get advice to people. That's how I love people, I think. But the taking your kid to work even at a very young age. You know, we heard yesterday Dr. Vernon having his two sons with him and showing them agriculture throughout the country. They came to the reception last night, engulfing them in our industry. So can you help us understand the importance of reaching out to students at that early age? And do you have any data or examples to reinforce that investing at that young age pays off longer in the long run?
Yes, I certainly do. And you're probably wondering, how do I have all this experience with elementary education? But I do. My first two degrees, my bachelor's and my master's, were in elementary education. So I started teaching for the Indianapolis Public School System. And so I taught basically sixth grade. And I ended my career before joining Purdue as an elementary school principal. So I have done a lot of work with students in grades K through six. And so I'm going to start my short presentation about helping you understand the importance of reaching out early with a study that was conducted at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And this study was a projection of the 10 years from 2008 to 2018. And what the study revealed was that the U.S. economy will create 47 million jobs by 2018. However, only 36% of those jobs will be available to individuals who graduate with a high school diploma or less, as compared to 72% in 1973. So what does this mean? You know, about 70% of our students graduating from high school nationally, about 70% graduate from high school nationwide. So that means that about 30% of our students are dropping out of high school, so not completing high school. So what does that actually mean? And I'm starting with this study and these statistics to help us understand how important it is to reach out early to students. What it actually means is that failure for students to complete high school and transition successfully into adulthood will directly cost our government as well as our society about $704,000 per student over their lifetime. Okay? What this results in, if a student is not able to graduate from high school, it does result in living in poverty, receiving public assistance, it results in an increase in crime. And so we need to keep all of that in mind. This really adds to the importance of really reaching early. And so I'm going to take you from that study to another study. There's a study that was published in 2000 in the Journal of Career Development. So you might want to look for the study if you want more specifics on the study. But this study looked at sixth grade students and ninth grade students. And what it revealed, and it looked at their course progression toward career development. But what it actually revealed was that about half of those students who participated in the study could only identify a few skills that they really needed in order to be successful in the workplace. But the most alarming result of that study revealed that about 88% of those sixth and ninth grade students revealed that they really couldn't see a connection between their academics and a career. And so that's where the gap is. And we're really missing out with students because we're not exposing them early enough. But what it also revealed is that sixth grade students, for the most part, could really see more of a connection between their actual coursework and what it was preparing them as far as a future career. By the time students reach ninth grade, there's a total disconnect, and that's why we're losing so many students in high school. That's why so many students are dropping out, because there's so much of a disconnect between what they're actually studying in school and a relationship to a type of career or some type of job after they graduate. So if students don't see that connection, then why continue in high school? There are other opportunities out there in the street. You know, gangs, you know, there's other ways of making money illegally, and so they'll drop out for that reason. And so we really have to take that into consideration. Also, early outreach, we've also found that sex role stereotypes, particularly about gender-appropriate occupations, are formed early, okay? In addition to that, students at risk, girls and minority students, often limit their career choices early. So reaching out beyond high school, or earlier than high school, as early as sixth grade, to help students understand and to prepare them to increase their career awareness is extremely important. Even reaching as early as elementary. Now, there is some conversation within the literature that says that, you know, you could put students at risk and you could pigeonhole students into a particular career if you reach too early and get them on a career path. But I disagree with that. Working with elementary students, you know, they're very vulnerable. They're eager to learn if they have experiences. So it's really about keeping students engaged. And we can do that with some of the programs that we have in place. The Science Mount program, I think, reaches sixth grade students. But keeping students engaged and keeping helping them to become more aware about careers and opportunities, and especially for us in the field of agriculture, I think is essential and very important.
You know, one point that Pamela made that doesn't necessarily play into that elementary age group, but as she was making her comments, that I thought about connecting academics into the workplace. Erica and I kind of share the responsibility with our marketing intern each year, and I always try to talk to those interns and find out, you know, what are you studying in school, or what projects have you done in school that correlate to the projects that we have. And we even had a candidate a couple years ago who had taken a particular class, and that class interested us as we were going through our candidates to bring him on because he had had experience in crisis management, and we realized, hey, we don't have a crisis management plan at Ag Careers, so that's a way we can connect his academic study to what we're doing in the workplace, and that also helps define the importance of understanding the difference between a work experience and an internship and the project related there. So that's not necessarily connecting the academics to the workplace at that young age, but still students are very impressionable, we know, while they're in college. So thank you for that, Pamela. Rod, you did a great job yesterday kind of setting the stage, and you went ahead and he is smirking already. and you did mention, I think you kind of covered some of what I have for you in my question yesterday, but you may want to elaborate. Education is always a hot political topic, and you certainly have involvement in political aspects in Minnesota. So what are you seeing within the state government that really backs up the support for STEM by educators across curriculums in Minnesota?
Well, weren't you the one that heckled me during my presentation?
That is correct, yes. Yeah.
My friends up here have something to say before I begin.
I'm not in.
Well, we have great panel selection, people who can't be bought off.
I said I would protect him.
Now, Pamela, I was so nice to you.
And
the
law. And you were very nice to me. Yes, absolutely. Probably wasn't curious. I witnessed it.
I love her. She has my back. She has my back. So getting to the question, and actually, thank you for that. It's amazing, and I'd like to have a copy of that as well, because it reminded me of, during the presentation, what I mentioned was, when I was talking to that educator, he said, 73 years old, and he said, I think we're doing a disservice. I think we're missing out here by tailoring a system that only really reaches out to about 30% of the students. And what you're saying about getting kids interested in that, you know, think about it. You can teach science, you can teach math, but in auto mechanics, you know, calibrating the carburetor, whatever the case may be. So you can strike that interest with those students. So I really think that the more that we have been dropping across the education system, dropping some of these classes, whether it's shop, auto mechanics, agriculture, whatever the case may be, I think truly we're doing a disservice to these students. And that's where it's so refreshing. Yesterday during the talk, when I brought up about how Minnesota changed the law to where a agriculture class could count towards a science credit. I had one friend here that talked about how Kansas is doing that. So we talked about Wisconsin's having those discussions as well, potentially Idaho, I think was another one. And so really, people are really starting to take an interest in this. And think about it. We had a conversation yesterday after, just sidebar conversation, think about this. We have to double our food supply in 37 short years. And if we don't have the people educated and in place to do that, what kind of crisis will we be facing all across the world, not only the nation? And so the sooner that political figures recognize that, educators as well, and I'm sure, and like I said, everybody in this room recognizes that, but as soon as we all recognize that, what is at stake here, the better off we're going to be. Double our food supply in 37 short years, and we have the baby boomers that are going to be retiring, so we're going to have additional people stepping up as well. It's absolutely critical. And when we were talking about making agriculture, you know, appealing and everything else, it was interesting. I was at the University of Minnesota talking to a small group, and it was great kids, right? You have the St. Paul campus and the Minneapolis campus. And the St. Paul campus, the St. Paul campus is where the Aggies are, right? So we had some kids from the Minneapolis campus there. And we were just kind of, I like to keep things light, right? And we're going back and forth. And one of the Minneapolis friends there started showing a little bit of contempt towards agriculture. And I said, and I despise that word contempt, or the definition of that word. And I turned to him, to this guy, and I said, tell you what, try living without us. Just for 1 year, try living without us Aggies. And he looks at me and I said, you know what, a few of you may be able to do it, but you, my friend, will be eating your lap dog within a week. You know? And the whole thing is, like I said, there is such a demand for people, and it is an honorable profession like you talked about. We have to get the political figures, the decision makers, to step up to where we can encourage ag programs and stuff back into these high schools, just like you were saying earlier.
At the political level, who specifically do companies need to be talking to help push this initiative?
Well, you know what? It's the vast majority, if not all, I'm going to just speak from the state level, right? It doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, House, or Senate. The people that serve there, it's a citizen legislature. And the people that serve are good people. They're simply standing up for what they believe in. So where you start initially is with your own representative and your senator, and make that personal connection. Obviously, if you reach to the Aggies, reach out to the Aggies, and it doesn't matter, again, what party they belong to, but if you reach out to them and say, we have this idea, what do you think about it? They'll be extremely thrilled for the fact that you contacted them and want to work with them on doing something like this that is so important. You know, picture this, legislators, right? Again, it's citizen legislature. You know, I grew up in a small town in Iowa. I was a punk kid getting into some trouble, you know, and all of a sudden now I'm serving in the Minnesota House of Representatives. And once you get that election certificate, all of a sudden you need to be an expert in healthcare, in education, in agriculture, in transportation, and the list goes on and on and on, right? And that's why it's absolutely critical for the experts to reach out to legislators and educate us as well, because don't take anything for granted. So I would start with your own personal legislator, the individuals in your area. And then, you know, go ahead and take a look at who those Aggies are, the Ag Chair and the Education Chair, and work up from there.
I think those are some great points. You know, we don't always, from an industry standpoint, think about, you know, we get hung up in the regulations our company may be facing, and that doesn't necessarily fall into HR's plate. But from a human resources perspective, interacting with these political figures and having them to come in and helping them to understand what your company is projecting as far as your need. I mean, we've got great data. AgCareers has data. USDA has data that you can help them to understand that. And so I think that's a great charge to us all today as we talk about this topic, is to go back and put that on the calendar and have someone come in from our representatives so that we can share that need with them. Yeah, sure.
I mean, like, maybe based on that, I wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying. At the same time, I think it's really important for us to be realistic about what we expect educators in education, formal K-12 education, to do. In many ways, their plate is pretty full. Whether you like what they're doing, you don't like what they're doing, agree with it or not, their plate is pretty full. So one of the things that we often overlook is making connections with informal education. Let me just give you a little analogy that I often try and keep in mind, is that we never expect the PE teacher to make the basketball star. We're not coming out of PE saying, you know, they're not ready to go to Division I athletics coming out of PE. We never make that assumption, yet we do that academically. And so thinking about what are the other informal education experiences, obviously the in-person who plays basketball or football well didn't learn that all in PE. They didn't develop all those skills in PE. They did it in other informal things. And so connecting with informal education things, and I think that's a critical place where companies can tap into existing informal academically oriented informal education programs to get information, to provide experiences for young people, to provide critical experiences for young people, so that that idea of a particular career, they bring that to school, not necessarily school giving it to them. It should be two ways, but I think that informal, outside of regular school exposure is a great place to tap in. And a spot that for a lot of young people where they have a lot of talent is never developed because they don't get that extracurricular, academic-oriented set of experiences or exposure.
And I'm going to make a small plug here, but something that Connie has pointed out a little bit, kind of as a nice bridge for me. In agriculture, we do, and this, Rod had this in his presentation yesterday, we preach to the choir a lot. And we don't turn around and talk to the congregation. And we talk about reaching outside of that bubble. You know, we all tend to, we want to form partnerships with a group to get younger people excited about careers in ag. We turn to FFA and 4-H, which are great, and I'm a product of that. And I want everybody in here to support FFA, but we can't rely on them solely. And those are the kids that are already hooked. They already know a little bit about agriculture. They're already excited. They need some additional exposure to learn about the diversity within our industry, but we've got to do some things outside of that. And this is where my plug comes in, and I do apologize for that. But Lori Phelan is here from JAG, and Ag Careers a couple years ago partnered with JAG. JAG stands for Jobs for America's Graduates, not the military legal system. And she is here from Iowa JAG, and I'm sure she's going to have some questions and comments for our panelists. But Lori, if you'll just kind of wave in case anybody wants to talk to her. To give you my brief synopsis of that program, this is one of the projects I manage within Ag Careers. This was our initiative to start talking to the congregation. Students in JAG know very little about agriculture. JAG is not in every single state. They're only in about 34 of the states, so that's more than that was a thing. But different states have different levels of programs, and these are students who are at risk at a high school level, and they put them in a work readiness program. And so we have built this relationship from an agriculture perspective. The only two ag companies who are really working with JAG are ADM and Ag Careers. And it's been a great experience for us. I get to meet, interact with the students. There's over 40,000 students who go through the JAG program throughout the country. But we go in and talk to the teachers and say, okay, let me tell you a little bit about agriculture. Let me tell you how cool and how sexy this industry is. So when you're getting your students prepared from a work readiness standpoint, when you're connecting in your community and getting them hooked up with employers, start looking at your ag employers, because these students can make great agricultural employees in the future. And so if you have a second, if you're more interested in that, certainly you'll want to talk to Lori at some point. Find her. She'll be around all of today and time at dinner. But I apologize for making that plug, but it's just such a natural fit with the importance of reaching out and finding that young talent that we do go to the congregation and not necessarily the choir. So I'm going to open it up for audience questions to our panelists. If you have a question for a specific panelist, if you would name that particular person, if you want all three of them to answer your question, we have time for that as well. So if you'll just kind of raise your hand, Alan and Kristen are here, and they are going to run around with mics, and that will just help to make sure everybody can hear and understand. So Dr. Austin, we will start off with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have the panelists. I'm one of my former professors, and I am Dr. Nunnery, so pleasure to be here this morning. My question is this. A few years ago, the Wall Street Journal put out a article about diversity in the agriculture industry. And they cited PepsiCo, and what they said was PepsiCo, by diversifying their management level, it increased their profit margin for products such as Mountain Dew Code Red to market towards African-American populations, or Sabe Flavored Doritos towards Asian populations. My question is this, the agriculture industry, to be perfectly frank, has not always been the most friendly in most diverse industry. But yet it's got so many opportunities and it's so important to mankind's very survival. So my question is for all my panelists, what do you see are as mechanisms that we can do to increase the diversity across the ag industry so that our industry reflects the populations that we serve?
Can I respond to that? Just let me tell you what we're doing at Purdue. We entered into a collaboration with our former lieutenant governor, who was also the Secretary of Agriculture. She is left her office, of course, at the end of this administration back in December. But it's called the Hoosier Agribusiness Science Academy, and we added Summer Institute because we have students that we bring on campus. We were bringing middle school students on campus for a week and high school students on campus for 2 weeks. Just trying to diversify the pipeline, trying to expose students to the field of agricultural sciences and all of the opportunities. I think we're gonna have to start doing more of that because the pipeline is not diverse. And so if the pipeline is not diverse, then how can employers have a selection of diverse applicants to choose from? And so we're going to have to, as I said, you know, earlier, that early exposure, working with middle school students. Now, we've since then gone to, because we were only reaching about 20 students for that 1 week period, we wanted to reach more students across the state, so now we have a strategy. What we're doing is holding one day, and I think, I know that there are other universities that are involved in these types of activities, but we're having a one day, what we call it, an environmental revolution. Because number one, we cannot go in and say we're having an agriculture day or an ag day and invite all these urban middle school students to come and be excited about coming, because they're just not going to be excited about coming to an ag day. They don't know anything about agriculture, and what they do is equate agriculture with farming. So that's a turnoff. So what did we do? We tried to find something catchy, so we called it environmental revolution. We thought the word revolution would really get them going. And so we pilot tested it this year. And so what we're doing is having this one full day, providing lunch and transportation as well. And we targeted some middle schools who have a high percentage of students of color, probably first generation college students. So we're targeting those schools. We had 60 students at our first Environmental Revolution Day. The only reason we didn't have 150 or 200 students is because we had a glitch in the ISTEP test, which, you know, caused teachers and the administrators to say our students can't travel anywhere because they've got to retake this ISTEP test because of this glitch that occurred. But we're doing that regionally, and what we're doing is matching our regions up with our five extension districts across, because we're involving our extension offices in this as well, and our extension educators, to help us contact schools and to get people to come. But we're having an all-day affair. We're reaching more middle school students and exposing them to the field of agriculture. That's what we're gonna have to do. We're gonna have to work with the teachers, because the teachers come with them, and they were really excited. They had the same image of agriculture. Well, it's farming, you know. There's nothing in agriculture that would be a career opportunity for our students. So you have to expose the students and the teachers so that they understand that agriculture is a science. And then you have to go beyond just looking at working with agriculture teachers, because agriculture teachers are not located in some of these urban areas. So you have to expose the science teachers and help them understand that agriculture is a science. And so therefore, they need to get this information out to their students. So I just wanted to add that.
Yes, thank you for that. What we are doing as a company, Christensen Farms, you know, they on the 17th I told you yesterday that I'm sitting on this Ag Advisory Board for the St. Paul School District, right, that area. On the 17th, we've invited instructors. They're coming down, along with their 18 new officers for FFA. Some of those kids have never been out of the city, and 80% of those students are of color. And they're coming to Christensen Farms, and we're going to tour them around and show them what ag is all about. The other thing that we're doing is we're meeting with, if you've ever heard the story about many of the Hmong that came here through the Vietnam War, during the Vietnam War, I tell you what, those soldiers are heroes, and we need to recognize that. And their words, not mine. I've got some few very, very good close friends within the Hmong community. They said, Rod, we grew up in the jungles of Laos and Thailand. And after the Vietnam War, during that era, we were pulled from the jungles, and we were dropped in the jungles of the concrete jungles, if you will, of St. Paul, Green Bay, Fresno, you know, these different. They said, we are farmers by nature. And the whole thing is, we're in the city, and we have not found the route or the path to get back to agriculture. This is who we are. This is what we want to do. And think about us. We have a void of people that we're trying to get hired. Here's individuals that this was their whole life, right? And they're looking for a way to get back to the farm and do this. So we're working with them. I'm working with AgStar on their minority lending program, so to reach out to them as well. We carried a bill when I was chair of agriculture. It was Representative Swazinski that carried the bill to have a minority lending program that the Department of Agriculture is promoting as well, to go hand in hand with some of the private sector. So there's different things that are happening, but every single one of us can do that. These St. Paul schools, and if anybody, any companies want additional information, the St. Paul school is, for the first time this next year, they're going to have an Ag Day at Highland Park and Humboldt High School. Actually, they're going to have it at Highland Park and Ag Day. And so they wanted to make sure that I let people know that as well. And that's going to be in May of this next year. So they're wanting to do this. So thank you for the question. There are so many different things that we can be doing to reach out to the various populations, but that's where the future leaders lie, without a doubt.
Questions? Yes, go ahead.
My name is Don Kudnicki, and I work for Telemon Corporation. We are a nonprofit, and we work with migrant seasonal farm workers. I'm based in the state of Michigan. And in terms of diversity in finding some other talent pools, there's one to me in my mind which is very obvious, and that's the farm worker population themselves. And an example that I would like to provide with all of you, and I'm bringing this up because I really want to establish some very effective, meaningful partnerships with a lot of you that attend this conference. There is something in Michigan called the College Assistance Micro Program, and these are people who have a farm worker background who are given an opportunity to go to university for a four-year college education. Their first year is taken care of financially, and then there's some other resources that we try to accumulate and work together to give them that opportunity. This is a segment of the population. They understand agriculture. They know what the work is, but they have no idea how vast and how broad agriculture truly is and some of the other opportunities that are available. My intent and my goal is to really establish, you know, on-the-job trainings, internships, work experience opportunities for this population to get them exposed to the broader picture of agriculture. A lot of them have a tremendous sense of pride in what they do and what their family has done to provide a living for them. But there is some negative connotations, and a lot of times what they see is just the tremendous struggle that they've had to endure and their family members have had to endure. This is an untapped potential, just a wonderful opportunity. And beyond that, we also need to be thinking about a lot of these students, or the majority of them, are bilingual. So that just adds that much more of a strength to what they have to offer. So I don't know if I necessarily have a question for you, but there's a lot of work, there's a lot of individuals that our organization and the organizations similar are working with this segment of the population. We need to think about this. We need to make this happen. I really feel that there's so much potential with this group. So I just wanted to share that with you, and I'd be very interested to speak to anyone who might have an interest in looking for further partnerships as well.
That was in Michigan?
Yeah, but there are similar programs in other states, but it is based in Michigan.
Can I add, I'm familiar with that program also. I work on Michigan State's campus, and we're very happy. Last year, our College of Ag and Natural Resources teaches a professional development course where we help teach those students study skills. They're often first-generation college students to help get them acclimated to college and exposed to career opportunities in our college and our majors. So they pick our major because a lot of times they come to college and they want to help, so they pick social work because that's what they know. And we have had some successes. We have had some of those students get employed. But I want to call on a thanks to Syngenta, one of the recruiters who is locally based in Michigan at the time. Instead of me giving the resume presentation, we actually had him give the resume presentation of who would you hire? And go have them go through that exercise and also to tell them, I want to hire you. And, you know, more employer partnerships would be great to help with that class. So,
thank you.
And I challenge the employers to talk to me. We'll sign you up.
Kristen, yes, Laurie, go ahead.
Thank you for the shout out, actually, for Jobs for America's Graduates, JAG. And we are in Iowa and also around the area, and many of you are from the Midwest States. So, Kansas, we just started a JAG program, a big launch there, and South Dakota, we're expanding into Illinois. This program, the diversity side, it was intriguing to me because we work with at risk students from middle school up into post secondary, and often kids are drawn to our program because they're struggling to stay in school and they're diverse. And 60% of our kids are non-white in Iowa, and everybody says, are those kids from Iowa? So it's exciting to see that this population is drawn to a place where they can belong in school. So it's an in-school program. And Connie, we've had some opportunities to connect with your work in Science Bound. But your comments about the disconnect, there is a disconnect between businesses and seeing this population of students, and the students understanding what is in ag, and the more we can bring you to our classrooms, into the schools, and then after school activities, these kids want to be noble. They want to belong to something. They don't have that in their backgrounds, and when we see that connection happen, they'll follow you off a cliff. It's like the days of old when I hear my father tell stories about those old internships. Where someone would mentor you and you would grow in that industry and stay there and raise your children in the same industry. These kids are looking for that and they need that hope. We've stereotyped that population for so long, but they don't know about ag either. And I think they can find it. You mentioned, Rob, sexiness. I think they can find that and make it for you. They've got a lot of good language that might help with that. But it's that those programs like ours, nonprofits, Jobs for America's Graduates, that you could reach out to that can help make that connection. And the first word in our name, jobs, are what we're really trying to do. So I look forward to visiting with all of you and seeing if we can make some national connections, and especially here in Iowa. So thanks.
You know, we're talking a lot about diversity. From the folks from FFA, do any of you have any numbers on the diverse enrollment that we see in FFA?
25% of our population of FFA membership for this year will be of non-white.
So you see some growth there, efforts from FFA. And we have a question there in the back.
Yes, it can be similar from Syngenta. I'm wondering if the panelists can talk to employers in terms of what we're doing to help organizations understand unconscious bias in the workplace. Do you have experience in that area?
I'm going to turn to the two doctors.
If I can understand your question, you are asking what's being done to address unconscious bias or to work with?
I think to educate employers on it, I think you have to create awareness first. Because we're talking a lot about the pipeline, but once we get folks, you know, diversity within our organization, what are we doing with that group to ensure their success?
I don't know if we're helping employers, but we're certainly trying to help our faculty and staff in our college to understand how unconscious bias plays into a lot of our behaviors. And so, you know, even in the, you know, trying to help faculty understand that even in the classroom, as they interact with students of color and students who are from a different ethnic or any different background, that, you know, there is bias that we're just not aware of. And that awareness, as a matter of fact, we're in a phase right now where we are working on our strategic plan for the next 5 years. And that's part of the plan, is to have a diversity outreach to our faculty and staff. We have some things in place for students, but we really do need to help faculty and staff understand that. You know, when we have our search committees, I know search committees are being informed and made aware of this unconscious bias. You know, it's something that's as what seems to be as small as a name. You know, some people, employers, you know, you can see a name and unconsciously, just mark somebody out, keep them out of the pool for of your applicants, not even attempt to interview them based on a name and just an unconscious bias, you know, something you're not even aware of. You could prevent maybe a fantastic opportunity to work with someone new in your company or your business. And so that's a real concern. And so I'm very happy that you brought that up. As far as working with employers, I don't know, you know, if you have, how many of you here have a diversity effort at your, you know, within your company? And hopefully, maybe there's someone here, maybe you're already addressing that within your company, because that's where I would think that it would start.
So I'm piggyback on Dr. Morse's comments. Maybe that, you know, I'm just giving my opinion. So I'm not sure I fully understand the unconscious bias. Now, that could just be my simple way of approaching the world. So I advocate an approach that, instead of worrying about what it is that we're not conscious of, let's be intentional, and I like to focus on intentional inclusion. And so that's something we can get a hold of and get a handle on. So thinking more holistically about what we want. Some of the challenges that we face in terms of doubling our food production in a very short period of time, those really aren't my challenges. Those really aren't our challenges, because we're not gonna be here doing that. That's the people who are in high school. Those are their challenges. That's the talent pool, that's the thinking that's going to lead us scientifically in order to address those things. These are things I'm concerned about, and I think that we're concerned about, because I think it's the right thing to be concerned about, and I'm concerned about my retirement. I think we all are concerned about our retirement. Our comfort level is contingent on the young people in high school flourishing, thriving, being able to create an environment that will also allow us to thrive in our retirement. So when we think about intentional inclusion, I think about teams. If we were going to create a team, whatever team we wanted, a soccer team, if you have the skills, I don't care where you're from. I don't care what your background is. I don't care where you grew up, what kind of pizza you like. It doesn't matter. But if you have a skill set that's important for what we need to address, then you're on my team. If you envision the problem the same way that I envision the problem, you're on my team. If you've got the same work ethic values, even if it doesn't show up in the way that I go to work, but it shows up in the way that you get through a personal problem that was pretty substantial. You've got a young person who's figured out how to take care of their younger siblings and then get to school. Yeah, that's a work ethic I can get with. Then you're on my team. So part of it is, I think when we talk about talent development, we need to learn to see talent differently in terms of what we will need, which we cannot yet fully conceptualize, but we can recognize the skill sets that are going to be important in order to solving those problems. And I think that we overlook talent. We define talent so narrowly. Academic talent is so narrowly defined. I mean, the A, B, C, D, F, really? And I think, I'm not going as an academic, I'm never going to go against the grading scale. But I'm not worried about the grading scale as much as I'm concerned about there are other ways of seeing talent. there's other yet developed talent that we're not recognizing. I think we need to broaden our perspectives on how we identify pre-talent. What's potential look like? It doesn't always look the way it looked for us. Talent for my generation is not what talent looks like. The innovation of young people now is talent. The fact that they can, I don't believe they can multitask, but the fact that they can stay focused with all of this other stuff going on, that's a talent that we need to tap into. As they're developing independence, being able to function with lack of structure, being able to go out and find information, figure out how to download music that you and I can't figure out how to play. That's a talent that is going to be important in the future, even though it's not necessarily critical to me. So I think that we need to reconceptualize the nature of the problem and who it is that is going to have to solve the problem. I can't play on the soccer team anymore, but I can identify young people who can. I can identify, all right, you got a good work ethic. I like the way that you run. You got a good hustle. You understand the game. You can strategize. There are a different set of skills that I think we need to look a little bit more holistically, a little bit more futuristically, as opposed to solving tomorrow's problem or the problem at the end of today. I'm worried about next week's problem. I think we've got to embrace the idea that there are certain pockets of the population who have way more innovation than we've ever thought about. Who have way more drive than we thought about, because we don't think about drive that same way, and we need to tap into that. And I think, there's one last thing I want to say, we need to start thinking about our language about minority and non-minority. We need to start thinking about that real carefully. The one public school, white people are the minority.
I know.
But I have yet to hear us refer to them as minorities. We talk about non-minorities as being the majority. We need to start thinking about our language and thinking about inclusion. How do we get everybody involved? And how do we tap into everybody excelling? Everybody needs to contribute. We cannot afford to have anybody on not thriving. Leads to crime, leads to public assistance, it leads to all kinds of things that we don't want to pay for. And it's a waste of human talent. So
I think that
I'll be a professor now.
She brings up a good point there kind of towards the end and something to think about. I think this generation is more used to a colorful population than we are, those of us sitting in this room. And are we reflecting that in our workplaces? Are we reflecting that when we, you know, we've got to get more comfortable with that. They are comfortable with it. And so us providing those avenues, Rod, I'll let you make your comment.
That's interesting. 60% of the children in kindergarten at the Worthington, Minnesota school are minority.
No, they're majority.
No, that's what I mean. Case in point. You know, I'm just agreeing with you. And you know what? I'm sitting here listening to all this, and at first blush, I really struggle with that, just because. I'll let you in a little bit. My cousin was walking down Main Street of a small Iowa town, right? And everybody was, hey, Aaron, hi, Aaron, how's it going, Aaron? His grandma says, Aaron, how is it that everybody knows you? He says, Grandma, and this was back in the 70s, Grandma, when you're the only black kid in a 50-mile radius, everybody knows you, right? Right? And, you know, I take a look at, and I brought this up on the House floor, I said, why is it with immigrants that come to this country? Why is it that it usually takes about three generations for them really to get acclimated or whatever into the community? I said, think about it. I live in a small town, Mountain Lake, Minnesota. It's only about 2,000 people. 25% of them is racially diverse, right? The first, and it was, again, going back to the Vietnam War, and the churches brought over individuals, both Hmong and Laos. The first really struggled with language barrier and everything else, the first generation. The second generation started opening up businesses that basically catered to you know, their family and whatever. The third generation, going to school with my children, they're homecoming kings and queens, scholars, stars on the sports teams, sitting at my house with my children, you know. comes down to hope. I think the generation, or our kids, are leaps and bounds ahead of maybe the rest of society when we talk about this issue. And it gives me hope. It gives me hope, without a doubt. Yeah, so I very much appreciate your comment. And I always say that in tongue in cheek. I had this speech on the House floor when we were talking about, I'm a supporter of the DREAM Act. Because I always said that education is never part of the problem, education is always part of the solution. So I've been a supporter of the DREAM Act. And when I stood up on the House floor, and I have many friends that are Latina, right? And there's a bunch of people up in the gallery. And I stood up and I said, in order to prepare for this speech, because I was the chief author 1 year of that bill, I said, in order to prepare for this speech, I did what any grown man would do, once again, like yesterday, I called my mom. And I said, Mom, this is what we're going to be talking about. We're talking about minorities, people that were brought here that are considered illegal, undocumented, illegal, right? Kids that have finished at least 3 years in school, and they want to go on to college and grant them in-state tuition. And I said, so I just want to talk to you about your thoughts. And she goes, well, my good son, I'm her only son, but she calls me her good one. She goes, well, my good son, do you realize, and picture this, the whole gallery is full of Latinos, right? And Latinas. She says, do you realize, my good son, that your great-grandfather came to the United States illegally? And as naive as I am, I said, Mom, do you mean to tell me my great-grandfather's a Mexican? And the whole crowd in the gallery erupted in laughter. And I turned around and I said, I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing. I'm just trying to make a point that not everybody that came to the U.S. is from Mexico. Undocumented, right? And she goes, my good son, you realize that our ancestors came here, and your grandfather in 1911 came from Germany. Speaking German, who were we fighting in World War I? The Germans, right? She remembers as a little girl, she doesn't like me telling this, in the 1940s, as a little girl, speaking German, and the family speaking German, who were we fighting in 1940? The Germans. Our soldiers were losing their lives at the hands of the Germans. My family, my ancestors, they were spit on, they were ridiculed, and everything else because of the language that they spoke, being from Germany. Racism is stupid, and all that, it's just stupid. There's not a place for it. And that's why I was struggling a little bit with that. My kids, I have hope. They don't look at people because of the color of their skin. My son said, you know what, if my children dislike you, it's not because of the color of skin, it's probably because you're a jerk.
A question right here in the center. Alan, you've got the mic somewhere. Okay, and it's right behind you. Drew has it.
To add on to that, my son came home from preschool and he said, Mommy, he says, there's a boy in my class, he's different. I said, what's different? Well, he's black. I said, he's no different than you. We all are the same color inside. And he's like, no, Mommy, he's different. I said, son, the only difference is I didn't bake you as long as my oven as his mommy did. Yeah. He got it from there. He never said anything again. I have a question. You mentioned you're going to school districts and you're plucking out people. How do you sell the appeal to move to a small town, 2,000 people? You have kids in our small towns who are dying to get out. And when you look at agriculture, you look at farming, you look at my boomers are retiring. Our business has been in business 87 years. We're starting mentoring programs with them to try and fill that gap. We all moved to a small town now to raise our families because we started whenever. But how do you get that selling point into the younger generation of what these towns have to offer, or these smaller communities?
We don't know.
technology. Think about it. I was over in China, and we can look up what the temperature whether or not the feed lines are running, whatever else, it doesn't matter. And I've said this all along, you know, when it comes to education and everything else, we can offer everything that the big city can, you know, the metro or whatever, if we utilize and embrace technology. The same thing, you know, in these small towns, you know, it's nice to live there. I live in this town of 2,200 people, right? And if we start embracing more technology out in rural areas, really promote broadband and all this other stuff, right? We can start delivering home health care services right in the home, you know? We can do this with technology. And I think if we do this, we embrace this, and we get this established in these small rural communities where you can really embrace technology and not confine to, you know, bricks and mortar, if you will, and just, you know, limited resources, then it's not going to matter geographically where you live. And it's going to be through technology.
You know, also the literature on college learning behavior, first-generation students says that first-generation college students go to college and they return home. They go pursue career opportunities to raise their family back where they were raised. So, get them out, get them educated, and they'll come back.
Can I add to this discussion about small towns? You know, when we recruit students, I'll give you a recent example. We were our director of the grad programs at our college, and I traveled to North Carolina A&T. Met with Dr. Austin. He had a group of students. We visited classrooms. He had a group of students that we talked to. And as we talked to groups of students, one thing that students of color and specifically students of color, ethnic minorities, want to know when they come to a small town, either to work or to attend college, is the technology is great and it connects us across the world. However, where am I going to get my hair done? I know I can probably get my nails done there, but there are small things that we don't even think about. The small comforts that would make me feel at home. I mean, we have faculty members of color who look for the same thing, you know, who make those decisions. Of course, some people look at the school systems when they move, if they're married and they have children. But if you come as a single person, I can think of one person in our college now who just never felt comfortable being at Purdue in West Lafayette because those comforts just weren't available to her. And if she felt that she, you know, she felt that she had to go all the way to Indianapolis or all the way to Chicago. So, you know, I think it's those small things that we don't often think about in small towns that are missing for some people. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah. So I just wanted to add that because that's very real. And people make decisions based on what might not be important to me may be very important to that particular person in making a decision to move to a small town.
And a lot of us, you know, we focus on our onboarding programs and developing good onboarding programs within our companies to get that person acclimated with their job and with their coworkers. But I am a product of one of these people who relocated, came from a small town, went to a big one, went to another small town. I had to ask my realtor some crazy questions about banking, doctors, hairdressers, etc. And all that could have been, I mean, we were located for my husband's job, not mine, but had he been given a good onboarding program and that information was included, it would have been a lot better to help us acclimate to the area that we went to. We have time for about one more question, so I'm going to go way back here in the back. Someone back there has a question, I think.
Hi, my name is Ahmad Abdul. I work for JBS, and I want to phrase my question by quickly referencing my experience as to how I got here today. I'm a first-generation American, born and raised in Manhattan, Kansas, went to Kansas State University in the college bag, graduated in 2008, went overseas to volunteer, came back, was recruited by JBS. I spent a little less than a year in a beef plant working as a supervisor. Did some projects in our fresh pork facilities, and slowly but surely got myself into HR. And by referencing my personal experience, I believe that the career paths of today are not necessarily linear. And if you agree with me, my question is if you agree with me, and if so, how how is that being communicated to students and potential candidates? Because it's kind of a tough thing to sell somebody that, you know, while we have these individual charts as to how you move up in this industry, that's not typically how it plays out. So, again, if you agree that career path is there, not in there, and if so, how is that being communicated to students?
You
want to
tackle that question?
I can try. You know, within the company that I've been affiliated with for 22 years, I had a tremendous amount of opportunity. And I started in production, right? I moved to business development, human resources, and did special projects, you know, communications, whatever. And, you know, it's no secret. I have multiple sclerosis. My first love is production. And if I was physically able, I'd still be affiliated with production in some way, shape, or form, because I think that is, you know, the backbone of the company. But because of some of the limitations that I have, well, which I perceive as limitations, basically opened up so many other doors. And with this is just one example of one company, you know, a pork-producing company that I've had so many opportunities to do different things within that same company as it grew over the last 20 years. And that's where, you know, what I tell college kids as well, college students, excuse me, and I tell them, you know, if you're interested in this, you know, you don't have to put blinders on, take them on, because there are. If you're like me and you have ADHD, you know, and you want to do something different, there's other opportunities there as well. So again, take those blinders off.
Anything in that? Yeah,
Connie,
go ahead.
Actually, could I just add to that discussion? So, Josh Stroll from BASF, I think the unconscious bias and this question over here about vertical job family progression and lateral progression at BASF, so we're really trying in our employee development over the last 5 years to really focus our development for those individuals who are specialized, who want vertical development, but also on the generalization side, who want the lattice special or lateral development. So with our managers working towards trying to develop that and bringing that into new hires and our new hire orientation, putting them through our employee development process. Because what we're seeing is generations coming in really are focused more towards that lateral piece, but we do need still to focus on the vertical piece as well, because we do need deep experts, particularly in science areas and technology areas, folks that want to concentrate in those areas. So as part of the development program, we have those channels for that development. Which also then goes to kind of the unconscious bias piece, where we're hiring for potential versus trying to hire always specifically. And in our science field, we have a very diverse population. It seems to be easy to find diverse populations to go into science, right? Particularly with Eastern European and Asian populations, not so much with African Americans, but more so with the Asian population. But we're really having a hard time down that field. Conditions particularly for the sales, and that's what we're trying to do with the university relations, trying to reach in to try to add diversity. But one of the things that we're doing is training managers to have diverse thought and recruiting for potential. So taking out very specific qualifications on jobs. Things like you must have 5 years of ag background in order to be a salesperson. Right? That's not necessarily the case. You can be a very talented individual, be able to learn the ag side of it, but the relationship skills and future skills is something that you gain through school and gain through your background. Those are much harder to teach than the industries that ag. So I think a lot of it is working with your managers to get them to take their blinders off to be able to say, hey, I can take somebody with potential and train them. As long as they, you know, have that work ethic and have that drive, they can really get at it. So I think companies are really trying to work that way, but realizing that the team has got to be made up of some experts and some generalists.
And
you're out of time, I'm sorry. I just wanted to comment on there and ask everyone here. Brilliant voice. Drew Rabbit with Dowder Sciences, and I agree with those comments, and they're very much along the same lines. We at Dowder Sciences are very active in the DMS strategy. Part of that is we are training all of our managers, hiring managers, people managers, recruiters, all on unconscious bias.
So we're doing those types of things. I know you're out of time, so I'll make it more of a comment than a question. All of our discussions in this session have seemed to focus on going back to Dan's opening welcoming comments, making the pie bigger as far as increasing that distribution. And we've talked really about widening that distribution to bring more diversity. What we haven't talked at all is that you've got to move this distribution to the right to expand the potential and the skills of the students that we're trying to hire, especially for trying to hire, in order to feed the growing population in the next 35 years. So we've not really talked about professional development in this session, and I think that warrants some more discussion through the rest of the round table. And I'll add one last comment. A lot of the programs that we're involved in both diversity and professional development, start with a grant proposal. And I'm really worried what happens when those funds aren't there to continue to pay for this kind of time.
And I think this is going to bridge well into our next panel discussion. That's what we have following. We are going to take a break, but our next panel discussion is going to focus more on some of those skills things that we've talked about a little bit, and partnering with industry and education, partnering to find those skills and hone those skills. So we've got a good bridge here. I want to thank our panelists for their comments today.